everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story Is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Wow, and this is a perfect movie for talking about that.
Isn't it, though?
It is. This is episode number 70, and we're going to talk about Pan's Labyrinth by director Guillermo del Toro. Director and writer, right?
And producer, I think.
And producer.
Yeah.
And also he did The Craft Table.
He's a one-man band, this guy.
Yeah, what a terrific movie. I'd seen this before, and I have a completely different view of it now than I did that first time I saw it.
Oh, how long ago did you see it?
Oh, probably a couple of years ago.
Oh,
two or 3 years ago, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I saw it maybe then, or maybe even a little longer ago than that. Because it's 2006,
yep,
isn't it?
2006, okay. Right.
And I remember watching it with Rose and just being blown away, but I was also rather upset by the cruelty of one particular character, which this time through, I don't know if it's because I expected it or because movies have gotten that much more horrific, that my husband said, he's pretty horrible, but he's not as horrible as I thought he'd be. And I was like, yeah, I know.
Well, there's one particular scene that's cringeworthy. I was like, ah, yeah.
But there's several.
Yeah, yeah, but one in particular that was really that really hit me anyway.
With him and
him
Mercedes.
And, no, him and the bottle.
Yeah, well, that's a bad one. That's the one that introduces you to that side of him, and then yeah, anytime he picks up a hammer, just don't even look.
Oh
just,
boy,
just saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So now that we've got everybody ready for the horrific side of it, but
it is Halloween. I mean, it is horrific, but I loved the movie. I thought it was terrific.
Yeah, and I guess because this time through I knew the story, so that's when you can look for little details. And of course, I knew we'd talk about it, so I could think about it more. I was once again really blown away by the underlying symbolism. If you're Catholic and you're watching this, when they get to the end, you're just, oh my gosh, he did that thing. He went there.
He did. That's great. Yeah, and I had a certain view of this movie, which I'll explain after we talk about it a little bit more, that was destroyed by watching it the second time, which is a good thing. But we'll talk about it more.
All right. So Pan's Labyrinth is set during the Spanish Civil War, and it's about a little girl, Ophelia, and her mother, who are, you first see them, they're in a nice car, army escort, on their way somewhere. You find out it's to meet the little girl's stepfather, the captain, and the mother's about to have a baby, well, or very shortly going to have a baby, and they're meeting him out at, it looks like some country house, very wealthy type country house, out in the middle of nowhere, but it soon turns out this is also a place where a lot of rebels, I guess, do they call them rebels? Anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Freedom fighters, let's call them. They've got some kind of headquarters out there nearby, and so the captain is determined to search them down and get them. So you've got a dual story, because you have the story of the freedom fighters and the captain to a lesser extent. And then when Ophelia's there, she sees a fairy. And the fairy leads her into a series of very magical adventures with a faun. And they call him Pan in the English translation, but he's not specifically the god Pan. He's just a faun, a half-human, half-man with horns.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, why? Yeah. I wonder if Del Toro was upset about the title. Because the movie, as we should mention, the movie is in Spanish. I saw it with subtitles. And it was called El Labertino del Fano. So, but then in the English title, they actually say Pan's Labyrinth, when it's not, like you said, it's not really Pan. I wonder if that annoyed him.
God.
I wonder if that annoyed him and if that was some decision that...
Well, I think he may have just been happy to get the whole thing produced.
Oh, I'm sure, yeah.
in some of the information that my husband was reading, he said that they made it on a shoestring. And so my husband had never seen it, and he was expecting something, I don't know, hand puppets. What happened is it opens up and you first see the faun, and my husband's like, I thought he said they did this on a shoestring. And later what he said is that they actually were able to get a lot of people to give their efforts toward this for a very low price because they were all getting going. Or all believed in the movie. And I did see that among the big string of producers, I believe, so the people who put up money, one of them was Alfonso, oh gosh, what's his name, Cuaron?
Cuaron? C-U-A-R-O-N?
Yeah, the guy who just did Gravity.
Yeah, Gravity, and he did the best Harry Potter movie.
Right, exactly, who is a well-known Spanish director. So it was like, you know, you could see all the people in the industry kind of grouping together to help this movie get made. So that was kind of neat, but that's off topic. But anyway, so at some point she goes into this magical underworld and meets the faun, who's quite impressive. And he tells her that she's actually a princess who's been reborn, and she needs to complete 3 tasks so she can go live with her parents. And they also will flourish if she does do these tasks. The fairies and the faun, and the fairies don't really look like fairies at the beginning. Anyway,
yeah.
So it's kind of this, describing it like that makes it sound almost like Disney-like. This is kind of the way it's produced. It looks so real because it's kind of earthy and old.
Yeah, it's you know, it flits between these two worlds. There's a fantasy world going on and then, you know, reality, quote unquote. And reality is very difficult, very tough. This Spanish Civil War, you know, there are rebels, and then there's this fascist, Vidal, I think it was his name. Mm-hmm. He's, you know, the captain, and he's just horrible. And, you know, and then it goes to the fantasy world. And the fantasy world is really stunning. You know, I don't know that I'd be comfortable in any of it. You know, so it's not like, you know, something that I would say, ooh, it would be so cool to go there. It was really strange.
Well, and then the little girl, of course, is interested in this because, you know, you would be interested in this. And
yeah, one of the first things that happens when we see her is she's reading a fairy story, and her mom's like, oh, that's, you know, you shouldn't be reading that stuff. And
well, yeah, because she goes and finds, like, well, her mother's not doing very well. So she's, oh, you've got to stop the car. You know, she stands there trying to not get sick. So the little girl goes running off into the woods, or wandering off, and with her book. And she finds the eye of an old statue, like an old pagan-looking statue. And she just picks up this piece of stone. And then she sees the statue and kind of fits it into place. And when she does that, this large, odd-looking insect, almost like a praying mantis-esque type bug, comes out. And then she goes and tells her mother, I saw a fairy. And her mother's like, oh, really? You've got to stop this. The captain hates it when you talk like this. And try and call him father. She's like, but my real father, he's dead. And so in a very economical way, they tell the story of the father who was the tailor. And it just now occurs to me that a lot of fathers in fairy tales are tailors.
Yeah.
Now that are cobblers, or, you know, they have a trade, they're not peasants, but they're not educated or noble.
Yeah.
That never occurred to me.
That's interesting. I watched some of the director's commentary, and I watched basically from the beginning of the movie until where they meet Captain Vidal for the first time. And then I watched probably the last 10 minutes of the commentary, and I was so impressed. This is one of the best director's commentaries I've ever heard. I'm so impressed with it that I'm going to have to watch the whole thing. Now, I wrote this down because I listened to it again this morning because I wanted to write these names down. But in those first 10 minutes, he mentioned Borges, Dickens, Wizard of Oz, Hans Christian Andersen's The Matchbook Girl, Alice in Wonderland, and Oscar Wilde.
Really?
In the first 10 minutes of the commentary, yeah.
Oh, okay. I was going, I didn't hear that in the movie at all.
Yeah,
okay.
And one of the things that he said that I think you might find interesting, and you may know this already, but the first time that she meets him, Captain Vidal, which is her stepfather, she sticks out her left hand to shake, and he grabs it and he says, "That's the wrong hand."
Yeah.
Which is, you know, horrible.
Yeah, he's awful.
But he, Del Toro said that's a direct quote from David Copperfield. When David Copperfield met his stepfather, he said, in the cemetery outside the church. So I tried to look it up so I could read it, but I couldn't find it in the text. So, because I haven't read David Copperfield, I'm afraid, which,
no,
you know,
in fact,
I need to.
I was thinking that might be the next one I read.
Oh, fun. Yeah. Well, let's do it for here because I'm all for that. You know, David Copperfield. It is one of the things I want to read.
Maybe we'll have to read a book we haven't read and that will be it.
Yeah, cool.
Well, that's interesting because...
So, I mean, you said, you know, it's, you know, a lot of the fathers are tailors and stuff. And I'm like, that's really interesting because, he's got all these influences going on and purposeful... little pieces of dialogue from other things and, you know, that could definitely be from one of these stories that he was, you know, I don't know if you'd call it a homage. He's just throwing all this stuff in there throughout the whole story and it's all there to find.
Well, and at the same time, and I could be wrong, but it seems very original.
Mm-hmm.
Because he does tie the two stories together. You know, the captain's story in its own human way is very mythical or fairy tale-ish. Also, his father died on the field of battle, a great general, and his pocket watch cracked and he wanted it given to his son so that he'd know the time he'd die or something like that.
Yeah.
And he realized that he's been looking at this watch all the time and it's cracked. And so he pulls it out a lot and looks at it kind of like, oh, it's still ticking. Okay. And puts it away. But he is determined to have a son. His family lineage is what he is most proud of. Mm-hmm. And he is determined at all costs to have everything set up for his son to be born into the world that is the best he can possibly make it. But yet he's very inhuman. He's like an ogre or a giant story.
Yeah, as an illustration of that, remember when he said to the doctor, you know, hey, if you have to choose, be sure and save that kid.
Yeah.
You know,
he didn't care
what he had to do, but yeah.
Right. He keeps saying, my son. And I keep thinking, you're watching the movie thinking, oh, God help us all if that's a girl.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the mother is tied into the whole thing too, because she'll tell the little girl, tell your brother a fairy tale.
Yeah.
You know, she'll lie down to go to sleep and the little girl will start whispering to her stomach, to the baby.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's interesting. The whole thing. Well, and you know, a lot of times the son is the one who will carry out a fairy tale, but in this case, it's the little girl. But the originality I was thinking of is, I mean, think of the tasks she has to do. A lot of times there are toads. There are trees that have something growing at the root. There are gems. There are monsters chasing you. There are things where you have to don't eat or drink and you're terribly tempted. All those things are woven together, but in such a way that it makes a new and original tale.
Yeah.
But now that you say that, the thing with the chalk, that's one of my favorite but little known Hans Christian Andersen stories. He's got chalk and he is misleading somebody who's following him.
Oh, how cool.
Yeah.
And I mean, and then the whole thing, you know, she's a reader. She just loves to read.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it's just neat that all that's in there because it's, you know, all in there on purpose. It's really cool.
It's because you get to the end, and which we won't talk about quite yet, though I'm dying to. And you look at it and you go, this cannot possibly be accidental. He was working toward this particular goal and these particular symbols. And he's obviously very into symbols. But I thought, I didn't write down the whole bit, but at the very beginning, there's a narrator.
Mm-hmm.
And he's talking about the whole situation, I guess. And he says, men talked about the pain, but never about the promise. And I wrote that down because I thought, isn't that how it always is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You talk about the pain because that's what you're involved in and that's what hurts. But do you talk about the promise, about what's beyond it, about the reward? And that's, in essence, what this little girl is going through. Those tasks aren't easy for her. And she suffers at regular people's hands because of them.
Mm-hmm.
And doesn't tell them anything about it because, of course, she would be thought insane. And at the same time, she's trying to help things in her own world as best she can. Not through human means, but through the fairy tale, getting the fairy tale creatures to help her.
Yeah, through what she can do.
Right? Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. The fawn helps her with her mother's son, you know, her mother's health some, that kind of thing. And so, but she is focused on the promise.
Mm-hmm.
If you do these three tasks, you'll be a princess again. She doesn't stop and think about what does that mean. She just says, well, I just believe in the promise.
Yeah.
But so that's essentially the story, is she's trying to carry out her tasks. The captain mm-hmm. has his own task and his own promise that he's thinking of. And inevitably, they collide.
Yeah.
And the mother is caught in the middle, in a sense, because she loves her daughter and wants to protect her. But she knows this captain is obviously not somebody that she married for love. She married him because she was probably at her wit's end and they were going to starve or something.
Yeah, and I think that contributed to what I would call the misreading of the movie that I experienced the first time I watched
mm-hmm.
it. That first moment where we see the mother and daughter, and like you said, she said, be sure and call this guy father.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how many movies, and in real life too, I mean, the most dangerous thing to a girl is her mom's boyfriend. You
yeah.
know, I think that that's really true in life.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that put me instantly on alert. So I'm thinking, hey, this girl's being abused and she's making this stuff up in order to cope. And then there's some things when we get to the end and we start to talk about it that cemented that for me at the very end. But I missed a whole lot of things along the way. But for some reason, that first time I watched that movie, that was in my head, and at the end, it validated it for me. So this time when I watched it, I had that in my mind the whole time, and I thought, you know, there's going to be clues along the way. And I watched it, and there were none. So I thought, oh, okay, boy. And then when I watched the director's, the commentary, like I said, the last 10 minutes of the commentary, Del Toro actually addresses, he said, some people think that the fantasy in this movie is not real in the movie. But he was adamant that it was. It absolutely was real. So,
mm-hmm.
So my reading that first time I watched it was totally off.
Well, and in that sense, I was going to say in the movie, but there is no book.
Mm-hmm.
But that makes me think of the movie telling of The Wizard of Oz.
Mm-hmm.
Where in the movie, you're left to think, because all those people that she knows and loves were characters in the movie.
Yeah.
You're left to think, oh, she either really was there, or it was, she had a brainstorm or whatever. And so that's left open. Whereas in the book, The Wizard of Oz books, there is no doubt. Mm. It is a real land. She was there. None of those people were anything like the creatures or people she encountered.
Oh, that's interesting. I wonder why the movie does that.
I don't know, but maybe just to say for everybody, like, look, here's the farm.
I don't know. Sometimes in movies, I think they just do things and they don't really think about it. You know, and
but
that
it worked.
Yeah, sure.
But
it just changes the meaning.
Well, and I wonder how many people out there. Because this may just have been my own naive watching of the movie when I first watched it. And then this time, I was really surprised when you brought that up in email yesterday and just went, mm-hmm. I was always thinking it was in her own head. And I was like, what? I never thought that.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought it was real. And to me, the very first proof of it, although I could see how this would go the other way, was when she said, I thought I saw a fairy. And I was like, I'm pretty sure that was a very unusual looking insect. But then mm-hmm. it's not acting in an insectoid way at all. And so when it looks at the picture of the fairy in the book and changes itself to look like that fairy, I was charmed. Instead of thinking she was manipulating reality to suit herself, this little girl, I looked at it and went, oh, in a sense, remember, Catholic mm-hmm. podcast here. It's like angels when they appear to people. Having to say, mm-hmm. don't be afraid. They have to take on a form that you can even see and understand. And sometimes they'll appear to you as regular people because that's how you'll understand and see them and listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
And those are her guides in that way, as is the fawn.
Yeah.
So I just kind of looked at that and went, oh, and I was just sucked in completely. But my husband, when I told him what you had said, he said, oh, I did think of that at the beginning. And I thought, oh, I kind of found it sweet, actually. I was like, oh, it's the manly impulse to protect the weak or the little girls that you'd think of that.
Hmm.
Because later when Mercedes says, Mercedes is being caught or whatever, and she goes, don't you touch her. Don't you touch that little girl. And I was like, she's so young. Why would he do anything? You know?
Yeah. I mean, and that, I don't know.
No.
Well, and when I was watching it too, an interesting thing that I noticed was that the captain kept touching Mercedes. I don't know if you noticed that.
I did this time.
Yeah. But every time he did, you know, she flinched a little bit, but I don't know if that was maybe implying something was going on behind the scenes, but,
he didn't
do that. Yeah. He didn't touch the girl. Like Mm-mm. that. So I was thinking, you know, if he was telegraphing some kind of an abuse situation, you know, he really didn't. And if that had been happening throughout, then I would have said, yeah, she's definitely making it up. But that was not his intent. You know, the director's intent was, no, she was not.
Right.
So.
I felt he was a traditional evil stepfather to her.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't care about her. He didn't care.
I think that's the key right there. He did not give a crap about her at all. She was just there, and she was just baggage because he wanted the mom to have his son, and she didn't even care about the mom. So
no,
yeah,
that's made really clear.
Right. Yeah. So. Yeah, I think that's the worst thing is just no desire whatsoever. Yeah.
If we talk about the other stuff that's mm-hmm. in there, I loved, for one thing, this is so larded with Christian symbolism.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's just woven throughout everything. And I remember there was a commentary. Maybe it was when I reviewed it on my blog and somebody came in and said, well, but this movie is like this. And Rose, who'd seen it with me, instantly said, what? No, this is a movie about how to get to heaven. And I was like, yeah, in a nutshell.
Well, it's certainly a movie that you could point out and say, okay, now here's an example of a spiritual person surrounded by a lot of people that are not. And seeing the reality, you know, like what we do on this podcast, you know, seeing the reality mm-hmm. underneath and understanding this reality. And she can see it and lives it. And, you know, especially the captain. The captain has completely blunted any capacity he had to see any of this stuff.
Right.
You know,
because he can't even feel love for his wife.
Right, right.
Or even human compassion for her.
Mm-hmm.
One shudders to think of what that child would have been like growing up with him.
Oh, yeah.
But the thing is that when you look at all the things she goes through, those are all, when you say it could be pointed at it as an example, I just looked at this and the second time through and was the part where she's being tempted by the food. And she suddenly stops and looks at it. And my husband's like, oh, what? No. Really? And I was like, well, let's think about it. When we are tempted beyond what we can take, it never looks like anything big to the person on the outside. They're not being tempted by it.
Mm-hmm.
You can have, you know, the little fairies are like, no, no, they said don't do it. They said don't do it. And she's like, get out of my way. And then later, when the fawn says an accident, oh, you did this on purpose, or you know, you deliberately made the wrong choice. You didn't break the, you broke the rules. That was it. And mm-hmm. she says, "Well, I thought nobody would ever know." And I was like, "Well, there we have it in a nutshell, don't
there
we? Seems like a small thing, not a big deal. Who does it hurt? Two fairies died because of that.
Yeah, yeah.
And her chances."
And that is amazing. You know, we're talking. You know, it's like angels, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, no, don't.
Yeah.
And you're like, swipe, swipe. No.
Yeah. And you're like, I'll just ignore that stuff that I can't really, I don't want to think about that. I want those grapes.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
Right. And then the fawn comes back. And that's an interesting thing, too.
Well, because forgiveness.
Exactly. Yeah.
You have to know what you did was wrong and you have to think about it. But there's always another chance to make it right, to do the right thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Really, really stunning stuff. That's cool.
Yeah. Well, and because the other thing I thought was interesting that was woven through here is, you know, at the end, the fawn says, okay, I'm going to give you a second chance. You have to do exactly what I say. And, oh, yeah, I will. but the whole point of the test, essentially, is that she think and do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Not what the fawn tells her under great pressure.
Yeah, and who do we want to do exactly what he says? You know, that's Jesus.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, and because she had to think for herself and obey her free will and follow and not just blindly obey, because when you blindly obey is when you're not fully participating in the choices that you make. And that's what she does. And earlier that's pointed up for us by the doctor, who the captain says he kills somebody who is in great pain and just going to be tortured more by the captain. And the captain goes racing back going, oh my gosh, I just realized you've been giving antibióticos to the rebels. And he finds the guy has indeed given him, you know, relief from his pain forever, basically. And he says, I told you not to. Why did you do this? And he goes, well, it was the only thing I could do. And he goes, no, you should have obeyed me. Why didn't? And he's, seems actually really curious. He's like, you know what I'm going to do. Why didn't you do this? And the doctor says, to obey just for the sake of obeying would make me a man like you.
Hmm.
He had to, you know, follow his own moral compass. And that's what the little girl does. And that's what the captain can't understand because his moral compass has been broken like that watch. I just thought of that. It's cracked.
It's cracked.
Oh, Guillermo del Toro, you genius, you.
Oh, that's great.
I kiss you on both cheeks.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. But great. That's great. And yeah, I mean, this movie's just full of that kind of thing. It's really great. So what did you see at the end?
Oh, man. Hmm? Well, at the end, she's dying.
Mm-hmm.
And the captain is, you know, dealing with his own issues up above, but it's in a golden glow. Suddenly she's in the underground dominion or whatever. She's dressed beautifully. It's like a huge hall or cathedral. And at the far end on impossibly high thrones are a very old man looking man, her mother, who's now got white hair because it was there's something to do, some connection with the full moon, which later we were going, oh, it's the only thing providing light in the darkness, isn't it? It's the full moon. And but she's there and it looks like she's holding a baby. That's one of the things that we kept rewinding to look at. But, you know, he's saying you passed the test. The blood of the innocent was shed. You did exactly what you needed to do because she sacrificed herself to save her brother.
Mm-hmm.
And gave up any hope of any promise that she was given to the alternative. And so she's walking down there. And I just looked at that the very first time I saw it. I was like, oh, my gosh, that's like God. And there's Mary.
Mm.
Holy moly. And behind them is this, when they pull away, there's this gigantic stained glass window with a big cross in the middle of it. Well, those things aren't ever put somewhere by accident.
Right,
they can put anything in there. And as she's walking down, all these unseen people, you just kind of sense motion, and they're all, as if they're richly dressed, standing up and applauding her for what she did. Mm-hmm. And I just thought of, oh my gosh, this is like St. Paul talking about the cloud of witnesses, the saints that are cheering us on, hoping for us to win the race. And to me, that was just so indicative of, that's why Rose said, well, this is a movie about how you get to heaven.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. Well put. I don't know. I mean, that's neat. No, that's terrific. Yeah, I had the same imagery in my head of God and Mary. I didn't notice the stained glass window, to be honest. And the witnesses there, you know, I was thinking angels and things. Mm-hmm. But yes, mm-hmm. still, yeah, it's very powerful. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in the commentary, Del Toro says that, you know, she became immortal right there.
Right.
And that matches exactly what you're saying. He didn't specifically talk about any Christian imagery. You know, he seems to be a type of, you know, all religions have something to say type of, you know, Joseph Campbell type. But yeah, it was excellent. Yeah.
Well, and because the other thing is that when we got done, I asked my husband what he thought. And so we were talking about all these various things, and he's not one for reading into stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But he's the one who's like, well, this is about free will. And this is, and I'm like, oh my gosh, let me write this stuff down. And, but I said, well, you know, to me, I don't think Del Toro would ever say that. But, you know, of course, there's some symbols that are just indelible in our cultures. And he's obviously quite Spanish, and that mm-hmm. would be indelible in their culture. And that would be a lot of the Christian stuff. But there are things that just resonate with all of us on a deeper level, because I feel like they're built in.
Yeah.
That honoring of the innocent sacrifice to save the other, the helpless other, and that sort of thing. And he said, well, it's Christian in the way the Lord of the Rings is Christian, via the guy's worldview and symbolism for the people who want to see it. And for the ones who don't, it's still got a powerful, well-told story that gives you a good message also, though, because that's the point of telling the story. It tells you a truth we can see to a deeper truth.
Yeah.
Which is very Joseph Campbellian, I guess. Mm-hmm. So
Sure it is. Yeah.
Since I haven't read him, I know of him, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've talked about him here before.
Yeah.
But yeah, you've got it right. You've got him right. Yeah. Everything, you know, religion is an attempt to explain the transcendent, which actually exists, is how I describe Joseph Campbell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and the thing is that when you think about The Lord of the Rings, and since I'm just partway through reading it very slowly again, excuse me, you know, there's no God or a lot of things that later when Tolkien got through with his first draft and he was rereading it, and he went, oh my gosh, look what I did here and here and here. So he kind of punched things up a little for people who wanted to see it. But there's no God in there. There's no, I mean, you know, obvious reference. It's not like a Christian movie where you're being hammered over the head with, you must understand it and here's how you'll understand it. It's the capital T truth woven into this story, which is what we're hardwired to love and understand. And that's, I think, what Del Toro did with this movie.
Yeah. Right. In the beginning was the Word.
Right.
Exactly right. I mean.
Right.
Yeah. Yep. I agree. Yeah.
See, also, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I also loved the fact that at one point the captain says, well, my weakness is pride. Now, he's saying it in kind of a proud way and also kind of ruefully, kind of like, myself in for this. But later, when he's got this horrific Joker-type situation going on, Batman's Joker-type situation, and he's trying to stitch up his own face. And I'm like, oh! So I'm kind of trying to watch through my fingers to read dialogue but not see the horror that's in front of me. And my husband's like, just don't look, I'll tell you. And he's like, wow, he is proud, isn't he? He goes, he's not taking care of his other wounds. He's stitching his face up, thank goodness. And I'm like, oh, I didn't think of that.
Yeah.
But it is. Pride is the root of all his problems.
Yeah, and it's funny when he takes a drink of alcohol and it clearly hurts like crazy.
And starts leaking through.
I think I'm going to have another one. Yeah.
I was like, oh, good thinking. I wouldn't have thought of that. Very realistic.
Yeah. So yeah, this yeah, the movie's full of that free will aspect of it. I think is permeates the whole thing too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, through all the characters, there's just a lot of tough choices being made throughout that whole movie.
Well, and the one person, now that I think about it, who is probably made a tough choice a long time ago, but we're not being shown her doing that, is the mother.
Yeah.
She's vainly trying to leave the little girl with, you know, have her reconciled to the captain and do what he wants. And the little girl isn't one of these spunky American girls who's going to sass him and tell him, you know, he can't tell her that. She just mm-hmm. doesn't do it. She just always calls him captain.
Yeah.
You know, or doesn't call him anything. She listens to her mother and she loves her and she wants to make her happy. But, you know.
Yeah, she's seeing reality. And I love the speech that she gives that her brother. Not mm-hmm. not the the first one was a story, but the second time she puts her ear on her mom's stomach and says, you know, things aren't very good out here. That was really good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't hurt your mom, first of all, but, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah. You don't really want to come out right now. Things aren't very good out here.
Yeah, and the baby is shown as a baby, mm-hmm. but that you get a visual of the baby in there listening.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's a lot of things going on with colors and stuff in this movie, too.
I think
I want to, you know, he mentioned some of it in the beginning there, so I know that he's going to talk more about it, but, you know, the whole movie has a certain kind of a color or a tone,
mm-hmm.
and then I think that it's different when you're in the fantasy world. And her womb has a certain color to it that seems to permeate some of the movie. I don't know what to make of all that yet. I'm hoping that he addresses it because he seemed to be in the commentary that I saw talking about some of that, and it was important to him. The colors were important.
Yeah, I didn't even notice that, except that, mm-hmm. you know, that princess dress was green.
Mm-hmm.
And she had to go down on the bottom of that tree.
That is interesting there, because you say that, and it makes me think that when she goes down into the labyrinth, it's mm-hmm. green down there. When we first see the fawn, he's in green light.
Ah.
So there's some type of a connection there, yeah. Another thing I noticed about the fawn is the fawn, when we first see him, he's covered in plants and stuff. And then at the end, the last scene, he's pretty darn good looking. I mean, you know that? I mean, his chest is clear and all that. That's interesting, too.
Because I guess you can see him for who he is because you're in that realm then. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so he changes throughout the movie. He's not the same.
Well, and I'm thinking about the fact that, you know, you were kind of worried maybe it was in her head or she was being abused. And I'm like, I don't know that was necessarily a wrong... It wasn't right for the movie, but that he didn't maybe mean to misdirect you that way a little.
Yeah.
Because remember, at one point, she says something to Mercedes about the fawn, and Mercedes just kind of says, oh, my mother always said you could never trust a fawn. And it's a throwaway line. Mercedes never mentions the fawn again, and neither does the girl to her. But you always have that in the back of your mind. Is he trustworthy? When she's doing all this, what's going to happen? And then when it's the second challenge or task and she finds that knife and gives it to him, and you're thinking, why did he need a knife? I'm not happy about this at all.
Yeah, yeah.
But even then, you know,
that's interesting. Oops, go ahead.
I was going to say, that scene I found interesting that she uses her free will both rightly and wrongly. He says, my fairies will tell you what to do. And they tell her she should open the middle slot of these three choices. And she's, no, it's this one.
Yeah.
With the knife. And she's correct. But then she uses her free will, of course, to eat those grapes. So.
Yeah, is in you know as I'm talking about it now and thinking about it, you know, you say that Mercedes says that, and I don't recall her saying that, but mm-hmm. it's like she's saying, you know, I'm one of you. She's a spiritual being too, as in, you know, she's awake to the reality, just like this girl is awake to the reality.
That's interesting. I didn't take it that way because it was since they were crossing the yard or so, I don't know what they were doing, but I just took it as Oh, well, you know, in fairy tales, my mother always said, mm-hmm. you can never trust a fawn. but Mercedes is living her own double life because Mercedes' brother is the leader of the rebels. And so she is sneaking food and letters and medicine. And she leads the doctor to them to help this guy who's got to have his leg amputated. And time after time, I thought, I guess this just shows how clueless the captain is, because anybody else would have found her behavior fairly suspicious. Until the rebels stupidly unlock something that they should have broken open, since they're going to blow everything up anyway.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you just knock the lock off? But that's when he finally goes, all right, Mercedes, I've got you now.
Yeah.
And,
there had to have been something going on between those two. I mean,
Maybe that was it.
That's why he was blind,
trusted her.
Yeah. Because it would have been against her will, but I just noticed because I was looking for that, he kept touching her. Like, you know, he'd put his hand on her shoulder and she would just get cold. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, what are you going to do? You know?
Well, and I know that, I did notice him continually like moving close to her and stuff, and she'd kind of freeze up and move away. And I hadn't thought about what was probably going on before the wife got there. I just thought about, oh, fine. Yeah, the wife can't do anything, so
yeah.
He's a man who will take what he wants. Although he didn't seem passionate about pretty much anything. He was a very cold individual.
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
And they did have some scenes where it was interesting in terms of, since I know so little about that Civil War, but any war is like this. You know, he has the local dignitaries come and have dinner. And the only one who seems sympathetic at all is the doctor, who we already know is on their side, on the freedom fighter's side. And, you know, there's a priest, there are all these people, and everything they say is either polite conversation or moving the plot along, or it's showing that they're kowtowing to whatever authority is nearby.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was kind of painful to see the priest doing that, but you know, that's how you go.
Yeah, for sure. Yep.
That's a human thing.
I'm trying to remember exactly what she said that he kind of rebuked her. Oh, yeah, they were talking about how they met.
Right.
She was asked to how did you guys meet, and she told the story, and he was really annoyed that she even told it.
Yeah, my wife doesn't understand that you don't tell these little tales. And everybody kind of smiles like, yes, poor bum.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's when he says, why are we here? And everyone's like, because we live here, we don't know. And he says, to create a clean Spain for my son.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, yep. Wild.
So.
Yep. But what a great movie. Yeah, I mean, huge juxtaposition. Juxtaposition. There you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Between this violent reality and then this fairy world, which also was scary, like I said. I mean, there was that thing without the eyes, or the eyes in the hands. I mean, that was wild.
That was ingenious.
Yeah, crazy stuff.
Ingeniously horrible. Well, and there's kind of another overall message, and that's the one that the terrorist tells his sister. She's like, you know, you can't ever win, right? Mm-hmm. And he goes, what if we can't win? Then we'll make it harder.
Yeah.
It's like we're never giving up.
Mm-hmm.
Because you just don't know what's going to happen, that what else in the big plan is going to happen.
Right. Yep, you don't see everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we haven't mentioned one of the first things Del Toro says in that commentary. He says, this is a companion film to a movie called The Devil's Backbone, which was released in 2001. So he made this movie 5 years later, and Pan's Labyrinth actually happens 5 years after the events in Devil's Backbone. But it's not like a sequel.
Mm-hmm.
It's he calls it a companion movie. They both take place in the Spanish Civil War, which is a period of history. I don't know anything about that. So yeah, there weren't Nazis in this movie, but they were definitely fascists. So. I got a little bit to learn about that period.
Yeah, that's one of those parallel periods where I think the Nazis left him alone and he left the Nazis alone because they were all busy fighting their own fascist fights wherever. I say he, thinking of Francisco Franco, but for all I know, he was on the other side. I have no idea. I know that he was, I've seen people going, well, he was very friendly to the Catholic Church, and other people going, yeah, those kind of friends you don't really necessarily want. Mm-hmm. So I have no idea what any of the things were. I guess that's kind of interesting, isn't it? So many wars that we do know about. I guess I should read up on that.
Should. So the description of the devil's backbone on IMDb says, after Carlos, a 12-year-old whose father has died in the Spanish Civil War, arrives at an ominous boys' orphanage, he discovers the school is haunted and has many dark secrets that he must uncover. So.
Sounds terrible.
I'm definitely going to watch it. it's got a pretty nice rating, so people like it too. But
It's always mentioned.
Just to see, but my favorite Guillermo del Toro is Hellboy. I just love Hellboy. I really do. I own that thing. I found the director's cut maybe 5 months ago or something like that, and I was like, oh, it's like 4 DVDs long. Haven't watched it all yet, but it's like, how can you have that much? Yeah, but.
Maybe I'd like the director's cut better. I don't know, but I like Hellboy.
I just think it's fun.
Don't get me wrong.
I love the imagery, and I just think it's fun. I really enjoy
it. I like
it.
Mm-hmm. It just wasn't rich like this to me.
Yeah.
It could have been more.
Yeah. And one of the cool things about Guillermo del Toro, I read years ago, and I looked it up to make sure this was really true, is he's got a house for his stuff. And I mean, you know, so he lives in a house, you know, assumingly with his family. I have no idea what kind of, you know, if he's got a family at all, but
he does.
He has a house that he calls Bleak House that is just a place for his stuff. He's got, he said he designed it with the old curiosity cabinet in mind. There are book rooms, there's viewing rooms. The place is just stuffed full of stuff, wonderful stuff. And I've got a video that I'll put on this post that where he gives a brief tour of it. It must have been off a DVD or something. And he's got like a statue of Michael, standing over
the
serpent. Yeah.
Wow.
That's in there. But anyway, you know, when you see it, it's just packed full of stuff. The only thing I've seen anything like it is Harlan Ellison's house. There's a name for his house too. I don't know what it is, but in a documentary one time, I saw his house, and his house is just, boy, if somebody lit a match in that house, it would just go boof, you know. So I just that's the only other thing I have to compare it to, but packed full of stuff, bought a house just for it. So
well, that sounds like almost like those in what. Would we say Edwardian or Victorian times where eccentric rich people could have their own museums because there weren't a lot of sponsored museums around. So they'd have their curiosities there and people, they could come and see them. They take them on tours because that brings up two interesting ideas. One is that I was listening very briefly to an interview he did on The Business when, what is the thing that he did with the, Pacific Rim. Pacific Rim came out. I only had time to listen to about half of it, or possibly was the interest to listen to about half of it. But he made it very clear. They said, well, did you do this for the money, for another project? And he says, I never do anything that I don't want to do. Life is too short.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so if I'm into a project, I did it because I wanted to do it. And I'm like, yeah, that's the Hellboy side of you. You love the things blowing up and the giant robots and the, I get it. And then I'd forgotten that he had been attached to The Hobbit. So he spent a couple of years on that. And he moved his family to New Zealand, to Wellington.
Oh, wow.
And he has children. And he goes, they move wherever I move because the family is the unit that matters. And he said, now my 17-year-old is starting to have a problem with this. And he goes, but we'll figure it out. He goes, families can be difficult. They're kind of this like a traveling circus in a way. But he goes, but as long as there's love, it's okay. And I'm like, that's kind of essentially what his base message is, you know. And but he also, so he was attached to The Hobbit and Pacific Rim. and The Hobbit fell through and Pacific Rim happened, and I'm just like kind of crying inside. But then, because The Hobbit, think what he could have done with it.
Oh my goodness. Just stunning stuff. Did you see Pacific Rim?
No. Did you?
I did. And I liked it. I mean, it wasn't terrific, but it did show, you know, this other thing that I wish that somebody would green light is the Mountains of Madness.
Right.
And there are Cthulhu type monsters in Pacific Rim.
Oh.
You know, that these things are coming in from a different dimension. You know, if you've seen any of the ads, that's, you know, it's, you could see it, but
I think the ads would come on, my brain would turn off. So, I'm knitting a sock. I don't have to watch robots. So,
it was a good movie. I like Idris Elba, and he had a pretty good part in it. And but it was kind of what you think it would be. I mean,
Rock'em Sock'em
robots fighting monsters, and you're like, hey, that was kind of neat.
Yeah,
but it's no Hellboy, for heaven's sakes.
I sense Hellboy somewhere in our future.
Yeah, I don't know. Oh, look at this. Crimson Peak, a horror movie, April 2015, starring Tom Hiddleston. Director Guillermo del Toro, writer Guillermo del Toro.
The perfect confluence of things. Tom Hiddleston and Guillermo del Toro.
Oh, heck yeah.
I didn't even see him with robots, but you know.
It's such a... I mean, he's so darn ugly. I just feel so bad for that guy. It's just got to be hell being him, you know.
Yeah, I only admire him for the talent. That's the only reason I would ever look at him. Ever.
Give me
Loki any day. Thank you. Over Thor? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Heck yeah.
Thor's okay. If you like blonde, obvious types.
That's funny. That's funny. So, I'm so impressed with this director's commentary and all of his books and everything. And clearly he's somebody who likes to steep himself into, in this little thing. You know, he says it's input. It's all input for him. All this stuff is surrounding and the whole thing is to create this input. Now, he wrote a book that I'm thinking maybe I ought to look at. It's called The Strain. Mm-hmm. He wrote it with someone else.
Right.
But I'm wondering now what's in there, because I love the fact that
he's
so bookish.
Did I read half of it?
Oh, did you? Was it no good?
Well, since I only read half of it.
Yeah, that's what I'm assuming.
If I'm thinking of the right book, it was a vampire book.
Yeah, I know very little about it. But
right.
Yeah.
At the beginning, if I'm remembering the right one, it was the beginning was interesting. But about halfway through, I was like, oh, I've read this sort of thing before. You know, you've got the factions and the, you know, people who want the vampires and people who don't want the vampires. And I'm like, I'll just go with the original Dracula. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah.
So that may not have been my right time to read it.
So it wasn't Dickens.
No, but I could be remembering the wrong book.
No.
Let's be fair.
It says a Boeing 777 arrives at JFK.
Right?
And on
that was really impressive.
Okay. And on its way across the tarmac when it suddenly stops dead. All window shades are pulled down. So
that was
who's
crazy
the first
impressive.
Person to go into there?
Oh,
I just leave it. We build a fence around it.
Let's just, a little bomb right there. Take care of it. Clean up the wreckage later. Well, the other thing, though, that I noticed, and this is via Amy H. Sturgis, who loves Halloween so much that she starts a countdown every year on the first, and she does a post a day with interesting things until Halloween. And she pointed out there's a line of Penguin books that are, I think there are six of them, horror books, Frankenstein, The Haunting of Hill House, which we're going to read next. And they've all got specially really great looking covers, but Guillermo del Toro did the introduction to all of them.
Oh, cool.
And that's when I said, this guy's making me think more of somebody like Neil Gaiman, who's just got his finger in a zillion pies and evidently limitless energy.
Yeah, that's neat.
Yeah.
Very cool. And you and I are going to read Frankenstein at SFF Audio.
Yes.
I'm excited about that.
Oh, man, I've already started listening. And I've been listening to, I meant to tell you and Jesse this, to Craftlit, where Heather Ordover, who was on.
Yeah, yeah.
She did Frankenstein.
Oh, really? Oh, cool.
Yeah. And so I'm not listening to the reading because it's an early LibriVox reading where there are a lot of different people and it's kind of variable. I found a better reading that doesn't sound as – sound quality is not the greatest, but the guy's a pretty good reader. And so then I'm just listening to the commentary that she does around it. And she's got some very enlightening points, as she always does. So.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, but it was – it's such a great book. I forgot.
Yeah, that's neat.
Yeah.
That's neat. Cool. And it does say here on IMDb that Hellboy 3 has been announced.
Buy that ticket now.
I remember the last time I looked into that to see if they were going to keep making them. He said, well, it doesn't look like that'll ever happen. And now it's, you know, so it doesn't mean anything. There's no date or anything like
right.
that.
Right. That's just wishful thinking, maybe.
Yeah. Well, I hope, I know, when they do these things, I always hope, you know, I hope you've got a reason to do it. And, yeah, a good story.
Well, I think he tries for that. He says if he, you know, doesn't believe in it, he won't do it. And yeah. he was saying, of course, there always is money. People aren't going to pay me just because I sound exotic and look good standing around at dinner parties.
Oh, that's
I
funny.
Loved that.
That is hilarious.
Yeah. But if you haven't ever listened to The Business or The Treatment, those are both from KCRW, which is LA's mm-hmm. public radio. So, you know,
yep.
they're both about, of course, movies.
Yeah,
well,
The Treatment
also.
Is one that I've seen or listened to on your recommendation. I've heard a few episodes of that.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, I just went through their archives and they leave their audio files up if you go look because... Since The World's End came out and I listened to his interview of Edgar Wright and he said, oh yeah, you've been on twice. And Edgar Wright goes, well, three times if you count when the Space DVD came out. And I went, what? So I immediately went and found and listened to all three of Edgar Wright's interviews. And it's funny because there's a common strain, but it's I just love listening to that guy. He's so clever
awesome.
And interesting and real. And it was interesting hearing him talk about Hot Fuzz, Scott Pilgrim versus the World, and Spaced.
Cool.
And I would
I'll
love
I'll
to
do
find,
that. I'd like to listen to that. Yep.
Yeah, I'd love to find an excuse for us to watch Spaced. I can't think of one. But I was like, oh, I need to watch this TV series again.
Oh, shoot. I need to just do that. I've watched a couple of episodes so far.
So. Yeah, I think you just have to say, I'm going to watch it, and then... It starts off promisingly, but it isn't until partway into it that you suddenly become more attached to the characters, and it's simply brilliant.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice, very nice.
But yeah, this and Hellboy are the only things of Guillermo del Toro's that I've ever watched.
Yeah, so I'm looking at his list. I'm definitely going to watch The Devil's Backbone.
Yeah.
And then he did one called Mimic, and I have seen that movie.
Oh.
It's a science fiction, you know, it's not terrific right. in any way, not a standout. It's about an alien that can mimic whatever it wants to.
Hmm.
So.
Rather like that second Terminator movie, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
But with aliens instead.
Right. Yeah. Donald A. Walheim short story Mimic is where it came from.
Okay.
So it wasn't an original to him.
Well, so
yeah.
aside from Guillermo del Toro and Frankenstein and The Haunting of Hill House, do you have any other scary stuff going on since this is October?
Wow. You know, on, you know, this is intense scary.
Oh, I won't write this one down then.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think you'd want to see this at all, but, Kevin Bacon, I like Kevin Bacon quite a bit. Saw him on Netflix. There's a show that was on last year, I think on Fox called The Following.
Right.
And, man, it's captured me. it kind of combines, a serial killer and FBI profiling type guy. The interesting about this and the thing that makes it different is that you've got a serial killer that Kevin Bacon captured in the past. And Kevin Bacon was injured during the capturing of this guy. He's got a pacemaker now.
Oh.
And this serial killer is a brilliant, you know, super smart villain, you know, that pulls strings from prison. Mm-hmm. And the following refers to basically a cult of people that are following the serial killer and mimicking what he does and basically doing his bidding.
See, that's just a dangerous idea.
Yeah.
No. That's what got Charles Manson locked up forever.
Exactly. So, yeah, Kevin Bacon is not in the FBI anymore. And turns out the motivator for the serial killer is basically getting back at Kevin Bacon. So he's brought back into the FBI for this. And it is incredibly intense. I'm about halfway through it. Yeah, it's it is rough to watch. I mean, I watch it and I'm like, oh my gosh, you know. Not me. It was on TV, so the gore and that kind of stuff is down. But it is definitely rated R. And it was on TV, so sometimes it's stunning now to see what's on TV. I know last time we talked a little bit about how TV, you know, there's a lot of good stuff that's going on, and you know, here I am on a Catholic podcast. It's not for your kids.
Well, we are all grown-ups.
We can't make
our decisions.
And it's just intense.
Like, you can watch it and I can accept that, but I'm not going to watch it myself. Okay, I made that choice.
Exactly. And Kevin Bacon, for heaven's sakes.
Well, he's so good.
He is. I really do like him a lot. Yeah. I really, really like his stuff. Well, one thing that I just got in from Netflix is Stir of Echoes. Have you ever seen? Well, you probably haven't. It's a ghost story written by Richard Matheson that also stars Kevin Bacon. I'll be watching that this October.
Okay. Well, I still have to watch the, what is it? The Devil's Elevator or whatever that was called.
Oh, yeah. Isn't it called Devil?
No, I don't think so. Oh, maybe it's just called Devil.
Yeah.
I know it's in an elevator.
Yeah, but M. Night Shyamalan elevator movie.
That's it. Yeah. So, yeah, I approach scary things cautiously, but once I find one I like, then of course I watch it forever. So, it's a funny thing because as long as there's a more supernatural element, I'm much better with it because it couldn't possibly be real. And then there's my oldest daughter, Hannah, this very gentle girl who was fearful for a lot of her young years, and she loves like Paranormal Activity and all these really kind of it could happen sort of things. And she says, yeah, it's because I was so afraid of real life for so long that once I got over it, I was like, she kind of embraced it.
How cool.
She's like, I like Frankenstein's okay, but show me a really horror movie. And I'm like, oh, no chainsaws. But other than that,
Yeah. I've always been, more bothered by those kinds of movies. I can watch Halloween, 100 times or 100 different Halloweens. Mm-hmm. And they're, not too terribly scary. But I watch some like Paranormal Activity and I'm like, that is bothersome. I think that the only movie that, and this is going to contradict myself, but the only movie that I left the theater feeling incredibly unsettled was Silence of the Lambs.
I did not see that movie.
Oh boy. Yeah. I mean, I left there
felt
thinking
I could predict that.
Yeah, I was really genuinely unsettled by that movie.
Yeah. I just didn't even like the idea. So
and now I'm watching The Following and it but it's contradicting myself because, I always say that, hey, things like Paranormal Activity, those are things that really scare me, but clearly I'm fascinated by the serial killer mentality, which is just horrifying.
Yeah. I just feel like that stuff is dangerous to flirt with that way. Well, yeah, and in fact, it makes me think about something interesting that I came across and I emailed you about it, where since I'm so immersed in Tolkienia, I guess J.R.R. Tolkien stuff, that I was reading a book called The Sanctifying Myth of J.R.R. Tolkien or something like that. Mm-hmm. And he was talking about the fact that C.S. Lewis wrote the Screwtape Letters, which, for anybody who doesn't know, are from the point of view of an elder devil advising his nephew who's on Earth trying to tempt somebody. And, of course, the point is it's written in reverse. You look at it and go, oh, my goodness, that's what I do. And so you stop, which is what most people do or keep in mind. And so, but he dedicated it to J.R.R. Tolkien, who was completely angry about the whole thing because he felt that to flirt with danger, like he felt he was flirting with putting himself in the mindset of the enemy, as a lot of people call the devil or Satan or whatever you want to call it, the evil one. And he just felt like that's so dangerous, which made me think of course, Saruman, which is what Saruman does, and he becomes corrupted. And so I guess part of it is I feel like I'm terrified by things like those serial killers and stuff. And the other part of it is in the back of my mind, I'm like, I just don't want to expose my imagination to really weird stuff like that for fear that something might take hold that I just don't know might come out. I mean, not like I feel like I'm going to turn into a serial killer, but do you know what I mean? You know, just do I need to have those images in my head? Do I need to have those things plaguing me?
Sure.
And your own imagination is fertile enough. And since we're all Catholics here, or if we're not, you should be used to this by now. Those things are used by evil influences to tempt you sometimes, or to plague you or bother you. And so why should I give myself one extra thing to deal with?
Yeah, that's a good point.
I'm not saying you can't watch that stuff. I'm just saying I just feel like, no.
You know, we've been through all the zombie training films.
<That's true.
laughs> So as long as we've got that, and you know, I'm thinking that I need to defend myself against serial killers too.
Well, okay. All right then.
Especially really smart ones that put things in place for years that spring on you.
Well, yeah, I guess those are a little elaborate.
Yeah. It's not unlike 24. You know, in that way, there are things that this guy has had in place seriously for years that people are, you know, it's like you can't assume anything.
Right.
Which is what makes it, you know, pretty interesting. But,
well, and that's what the kind of thing that's, well, not Hitchcock wouldn't have movies where, with serial killers like that. But what he did was he would take ordinary human circumstances and foibles and find plots and make these movies about them, you know, where you're like Rear Window and Psycho. And but he, what he was doing is he was making thrillers and not, and which is, I guess, what you're saying that is, it's a suspense, even though it's R-rated.
Yeah, it's a suspense, really kind of a chase thing, but they are serial killers and there is some of that that happens.
Well, because I think Rope is about a serial killer. I don't remember a lot of it, but I think it is. But somebody who gets framed, of course, the innocent everyman who gets sucked in. But his thing was, and see, I think that's the difference between what you're talking about and the, you know, like the Chainsaw Massacre, where he says, if a bomb goes off, that's surprise. If you know there's a bomb under the table and you don't know when it'll go off, that's suspense.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of what you're doing, is watching when those things are sprung on you, I guess.
Sure.
So.
Yep.
Anyway. We're out of time. And
Well, great. Well, this was a lot of fun. What a movie it is, too. It's really worth watching. And
I hadn't watched it more. Yeah. I'd only watched it once, and I was afraid of the captain, so I didn't watch it again. That was very silly of me.
I'm going to put Devil's Backbone on Netflix right now.
Oh, okay. Waste no time. I wrote it down on an index card, so we're safe on my side.
Oh, good deal.
So, let's see. Next is The Haunting of Hill House.
Yes.
And then, and then you've chosen a movie.
Right, yeah. I forgot about that. I did choose a movie. We're going to do Lincoln.
Yeah.
Steven Spielberg's Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
Seems appropriate.
Does it? Why? I'm sorry. Why?
I don't know. No, the politics just seems to be.
Oh, got it.
Yeah,
oh, okay.
Exactly. Especially, you know, there's not a lot of, you know, Congress movies out there, but this really is one, isn't it? Even though it's called Lincoln. It is about Abraham Lincoln, but there's a lot of Congress in it, too.
Yeah, and you know, I did see a lot of people went, it's wonderful. And then other people I know were saying, it's too talkative, it's not his life, it's blah, blah, blah. I don't like seeing him be a political guy. And I was like, we watched it and I was like, it's not too much talk. It's a lively movie. And if we think that Abraham Lincoln was this innocent, perfect, heroic guy without ever having to lower himself to deal with politics, look at the times, people. It doesn't mean he couldn't rise above, but he had to be realistic, and he was a realist. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was a great movie.
Cool. So we'll talk about that.
Yep.
Yep. Cool. Well, all right.
Well, so have a great that's couple that. Of weeks, everybody.
Yeah. Thanks for listening, and I hope you're enjoying October.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, because I'm going to read Rappaccini's Daughter on Forgotten Classics.
Oh, there you go.
So just get ready for that.
Exciting.
Yeah.
I'm going to listen to that for sure.
Well, have a great couple of weeks.
All right. Yep. You too. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.